The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Welcome, everybody. Hi, Jean. I'm very happy to be here. My name is Doug McGill. I see quite a few familiar faces. I come from Rochester, down the road a bit. I run the Rochester Meditation Center down there. You're all very warmly welcome to come by any time. Don't wait till you get sick to come to Rochester. Come right now. Most people wait till they're sick till they come to Rochester. And I've been coming to Common Ground for 11 years. And I really appreciate the chance to come and offer a talk every once in a while. I just finished doing the two-week retreat with Sayadaw Tejaniya, which is why I offered the guided meditation in his style tonight. And I thought, since I'm so fresh off that experience, I'd offer some thoughts and reflections on his way of practicing. And I'm calling the talk Developing the Habit of Awareness. Are we keeping the awareness from the guided meditation going? Are we keeping some part of our attention inward, noticing what's happening in the body, what's happening in the mind, what's happening with emotions possibly? Are we just keeping some kind of sense of global awareness as we're listening to these words? Am I doing that? Is a question I would ask myself. Those would all be very Tejaniya-like questions to ask. He's a Burmese meditation master. He runs a monastery in Burma, near Rangoon. And he has a very interesting focus as a meditation teacher on daily life practice and home practice. In the retreat at Spirit Rock, there were no mandatory sitting sessions all day long, except you might say the first sitting of the day, where he basically spoke for 30 minutes, didn't say much, but he gave instructions or suggestions for how to practice the rest of the day. That went from 9 to 9:30. And then basically all he would say is, please continue with your normal activities of the day while practicing continuous awareness. Just continue to be aware, to keep this sense of what's happening in the body and the mind going. The retreat was held in silence, except even for the last few days, there was a special practice for people who wanted to get a sense of how to maintain mindfulness or awareness while talking and in conversation. You could go to a special place and meet another person or another group of people, and you could practice trying to talk to each other while maintaining mindful awareness, the same awareness that you would have while sitting quietly with your eyes closed in regular meditation. Try to bring that to a conversation with another person. at the end of the retreat, he gave some instructions. Let's see if I've got that. I asked him in the open session if he could, address or talk about, you know, what would he say, what would he recommend in terms of a regular formal sitting practice, a daily formal sitting practice, you know, given, you know, that he'd been recommending this open, continuous awareness through all the day's activity. That was the one thing that he stressed for the 2 weeks. And he said that we should consider every moment of the day to be a moment of formal meditation practice. Quote, unquote. He said, every moment of the day when your mind is not otherwise occupied in a thinking task that it has to do, that we should consider that moment to be a moment of formal meditation practice and be aware. He said, going to the bathroom, standing in line at the store, taking the escalator or the elevator. He said, those should all be considered moments of formal meditation practice. He said, the goal of the practice is to be aware from the moment you wake up until the moment you fall asleep. Wow. So I wanted to tonight just offer a few kind of summary things that he said along those lines. Just in a way of kind of reporting to you what he said about this way of practice and how he described it, some of the practical tips that he gave for doing it, the how of it, the why of it, and also the question, you know, is that realistic? Because I know that as I've been doing this practice, which I've been doing for several years now in Tejaniya style, I know that especially early on, I asked that question myself quite a bit. Is it realistic to think that I could ever, or anyone could ever, be aware from the moment of waking up to the very last moment before falling asleep? And so I'd like to talk about that a little bit. When Garrison Keillor gives his little performances, I'm sure many of you have seen, he stands up in the front, right? When he's done, he just drops the paper off to the side. I don't have red shoes, tennis shoes, but I'm going to do that. I'm going to really enjoy doing that, dropping the pages like leaves. He actually started off the retreat on the very first day by giving a rationale for this type of practice from Buddhist psychology. He said, and many of you may be familiar with this, that in the Buddhist psychology, mind is always arising and passing away. It's not considered to be on all the time. It's really considered, the Buddha said in several places in his suttas that there are actually, there are six senses, the five senses plus the mind, and that a moment of mind arises every time mind touches an object. Then there's a moment of mind and it passes away. So what is actually happening constantly is that, and we can notice that, as is suggested, that we can notice that there's a continuous arising and passing away of the mind at these so-called six sense doors. And when something passes away, it's gone, never to return. But there is what Sayadaw called a legacy that's passed on to the next moment. And it's in the interest of this legacy that we practice. I was really touched by that word because, you know, it brings a kind of nobility in my mind to the endeavor that, you know, we come to this moment in life and this is what it is. There is nothing we can do about any of the moments that have already passed. And in fact, there's very little we can do about this moment, but there are some things we can do. This is the practice. And the reason we do it is to increase the chance that the legacy of this moment will be a good legacy in future mind moments. And the language that's often used is that basically there are two kinds of moments. There are moments where the mind has a lot of wholesome qualities in it, especially the qualities of stability of mind called samadhi, and wisdom. And there are moments that the main qualities of mind that are present are desire to get something, desire to not have something or be experiencing something. There are those types of moments also. And how we relate to the present moment will create a legacy in future moments as to whether those moments will be more like the former or the latter. Here's what he said exactly on that. He said, on the first day of instructions, he said, whatever you allow to live in your mind, whatever you allow to grow in your mind, whether that quality is positive or negative, will grow stronger and stronger because a legacy will be passed on. That is why we want to cultivate meditation. We want the positive qualities to grow, and that's why we have to practice nonstop. From the moment we wake up until the moment we fall asleep. Meditation, he continued, verbatim. Meditation is not a part-time occupation. It is not a pastime. It's something we need to integrate into our lives so that it is always there. Because the mind is not like a zero-sum game. It's either positive or negative. So we need to try to make what's in the mind every moment be something positive. Because if it's not positive, it's going to be negative. In other words, it'll be either something skillful or it will be unskillful. So that sets the kind of psychological rationale for this continuous awareness. I mean, but it makes sense, doesn't it? That we want to be aware every moment of our lives. We don't want to, I offer this as a suggestion. Check in. Does this resonate with you? Don't we want to be awake for our lives? Don't we want to know what's really going on in any given moment? We don't want to miss stuff. And I think that most of us can touch in with that kind of basic innate understanding that the reason we get into trouble, including the root cause of all of our misery, whether it's on the mild or the severe spectrum of misery, because we didn't know what was going on. Therefore, we didn't do the appropriate thing in that moment. It's not that we didn't want to. Of course, we always wanted to do the right thing at some level. We're trying. But quite a lot of the times, we're just not acting on the right information. Why don't we have the right information? Because we weren't there to notice it. Why weren't we there? Two reasons. There was either desire or aversion in the mind. That's it. What does that mean? The reason we miss on so much of our lives is, the Buddha said, because one of these two things are present, desire or aversion. If there's desire in the mind, we're not present because we're trying to get something that we think is not here right now. There's something in the mind. If there's desire in the mind, something in us has decided that the present moment isn't good enough. Therefore, we have to be spending our time trying to get that thing. The more time we spend doing that, the less time we're just noticing what's here and now. Therefore, we're not gathering the information we need to make good decisions if the mind is being driven by desire. Likewise, if there's aversion in the mind, somewhere in our mind we've decided that the reason the present moment isn't good enough is because something is present that we don't want to be present, and we're busy trying to figure out ways to get rid of that thing. And the more that we're doing that, the more we're missing what's actually happening. In both cases, our focal point of awareness is just winnowed down to this little pinpoint. If it's desire, we want that piece of cake. We want that donut. We want that car. We want that person. We want that sexual escapade. We want that movie or whatever. But it's just, whew, just narrowed down. And look at all we're missing because of the narrow view. Same with aversion. How many times, you know, like we go home after a stressful day at work and there's like one thing that happened that day and we can't get it out of our mind because we're so drilled down on that one thing. Why did that person have to say that thing? And, you know, we're just so tight on that that we can miss what's happening with the family, with the dog, with the beautiful weather and everything else because, okay, so that's desire and aversion. They cause us to miss a lot. So we want to keep awareness open to everything. We don't want to resist anything. We don't want to resist, meaning we don't want desire or aversion in any moment. We want to just be noticing with a kind of soft focus. As a little bit of a side note, I had a little chuckle this afternoon when I was putting together this talk because one of the quotes that Sayadaw came up with was, "The mind is a stream, and mostly the stream is unwholesome," you know, for most of us, most of the time, or it can seem that way anyway. And the chuckle was that I remember when I was a kid, I went to the Read More bookstore in Rochester, Minnesota, which was just like this, you know, kind of little cheap bookstore, and there was a little book there that gave the meanings of people's names, you know? And of course, I grabbed the book and I looked in and I looked under my name, Douglas. And so keep in mind the quote, "The mind is a stream and mostly the stream is unwholesome." When I looked in the book, I found out that what my name means in Celtic is "from the dark stream." Oh boy, set my life path. I really have, you know, I mean, it's true. I mean, I'm sure, you know, the Buddha talks about, he literally will define practice as going upstream. That's the one of the famous metaphors for meditation practice, going upstream, going against those defilements, going against desire and aversion. And it can feel that way, like we're going upstream because the momentum of those mind qualities of desire and aversion are so strong, and we're so, you know, our family and society, and so there's so much momentum that gets us in that direction that says the way for us to be happy is to follow our desires. There's even that phrase, "follow your bliss." You know, we're just so programmed that's the thing to do. Swimming upstream means just letting those go and keeping the open awareness and seeing what happens when we maintain our identity and our presence with the faculty of knowing something as opposed to that which is known. In other words, if you want a piece of chocolate cake, know the mind that wants that piece of cake. know the knowing of it. Don't stay focused on that, on the cake itself. Know the knowing. There were every day Sayadaw would meet on the retreat with people who with different groups, and they were yogis asking questions about their practice. And I remember one guy actually said, you know, I have depression, and I do you have any suggestion on how to practice with depression? And Sayadaw said yes. And he, by the way, he told a story about how he himself became a monk as a result of his battles with depression as a layperson. And it was his breakthrough as a layperson which really fired him up. And, you know, he took on robes rather later in life after he'd had a business career and a family also. Anyway, he had a lot of experience with depression, and he spoke about different techniques that he'd used. But the one that he really stressed to the person who asked the question was, there's, in the depressive mind, there's something in there that says, this is not the way it should be. You see how that creates a catch-22? It kind of locks the door. If the mind thinks that the unpleasant feelings that are happening as a result of depression shouldn't be there, then so much energy is going to be spent on regretting or bemoaning or complaining or worrying about the presence of those unpleasant feelings without any possibility of knowing what to do about them, because it just goes on and on. And it creates a kind of closed loop of complaint and grief and sadness. And the way to break that cycle, Sayadaw said, was to just switch the attention away from the complaint to the awareness that knows the complaining. The awareness that knows the sadness. Know that. Put the awareness there, put the attention there, and stay there. And if you can just do it for 2 seconds, that's great. Then try for three, then try for four. And he went on to say how he did this, and in the first days, it really was only 1 or 2 seconds a day, and then it became a minute a day, and then it became 5 minutes a day. And finally, he was doing so much continuous awareness at home, not as a monk, but at home, and also at work, where he ran a business. He was doing so much of it that finally there was enough momentum that he was just abiding more of his time with awareness than with the complaining about his depression. And that's what dissolved and evaporated the depression, was just that shift of awareness. On that basis, on that testimony, that really suggests something to give a good try, I think. That really kind of addresses the how. How to do meditation, maintain continuous awareness, and to keep the awareness on what knows as opposed to what is being known from moment to moment. He does pull out three elements from the Buddhist teachings in support of that practice of continuous awareness that we can pull in any time if we feel like it's getting weak or we're having difficulty on that track. And those three things are right view. That's the first step in the Noble Eightfold Path. Right effort and wisdom. Right view is the first thing to bring to our aid. I know if we're trying to maintain continuous awareness from the moment we wake up until the moment we fall asleep. What is right view? There's so many different ways to say what right view is, but one thing that Sayadaw really stresses a lot, and he formulates it a lot in these terms, he'll say, just recognize that everything that is happening is nature. That our breath is nature in our body, our bodies are nature, our emotions are nature. They're just happening in the same way that the trees are starting to sprout green leaves now. And it's just a natural process of the nutrients were there, the structure of was there, the light conditions and a million other things were there, and suddenly the leaves are coming out in the same way. Whatever emotions we're having, whether they're positive or negative, pleasant or unpleasant, they're just happening because all the conditions were right for them to happen. And there's no right or wrong to it. Now, there can be an idea or a thought that negative or unpleasant emotions are wrong or bad, but that's just a thought, and the thought itself is just another leaf on the tree. The thought itself is just another thing from nature. So this right view is a wonderful way to just step back and see what's happening as the unfolding of nature, and there's a lovely kind of disattachment that occurs there, and we take ourselves out of the picture, you know, ourselves in the sense of ego, and we can just see that what's happening right now, every single thing that's happening, is just happening like nature. And to just bring up these reflections is something that we can actually do. It's a practice. Remember right view. And that sort of lines us up to continue the practice in a helpful way. You know, if we don't have right view, then that's what happens is we do label something as good or bad, right or wrong. And then we start setting about doing things to keep the right thing going or to suppress the bad things. And then awareness shuts down basically at that point. Then right effort is the second thing that he stresses. Right effort flows from right view. And right effort, it just describes the attitude to have about meditation as we do meditation. And if we see that everything is happening as a result of natural causes and conditions, a natural unfolding of nature, then we don't try to fix anything at that moment. That is what allows us to just keep our attention on the knowing of what's happening as opposed to trying to fix something. And that's right effort, is to just keep knowing. Because it's on the basis of knowing, continuous knowing, that we get the third element that he stresses, which is wisdom. It's only through continuous knowing, not judging or reacting, but just continuous knowing, 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 that builds up this quality of mind called wisdom, which truly does know what's going on because it's been watching every moment. And when you watch every moment, lo and behold, you start making better decisions because those decisions are grounded in what's actually happening as opposed to what you hope was happening or not. Or were worrying that was happening that you didn't like. You start to make good decisions because it's grounded on accurate data. So we actually meditate to learn. We don't meditate to change our state of mind in the present moment. We meditate in this way, continuous open awareness with right view. We do it so that we can get the right information we need to continue on in the next moment. You know, I did want to say something right there, kind of parenthetical, jumping off of the narrative from Sayadaw's teachings for just a second, because every time I hear a teacher say something like that, which is, we're not trying to change our state of mind, I'll hear teachers say. I always put an asterisk by that myself. Because, of course, we're trying to change our state of mind. That's why we're meditating. we're trying to, and that's, I mean, even in his own teachings, we're trying to have more moments of wholesome mind than unwholesome mind. So it's not really right to say we're not trying to change our state of mind. What we're really saying, I think, is we're becoming more skillful, you know, at knowing how, over the long run, to change the state of mind from a predominantly unskillful and unwholesome mind to a more predominantly skillful and wholesome state of mind over the long run. And going back to right view, the right view perspective actually suggests a way of working with the mind as nature that's really along the lines of how farmers would work with their fields, or gardeners would work with a garden. You know, on any given day, the farmer can't make crops grow just by wishing them to grow. He has to know what are the conditions that he needs to set that increases the probability that the crops will grow. That's all he's got is probabilities. And he never knows what the weather's going to be on a given day. And he never knows if the seeds are quite the right ones or if all the conditions are quite right or what's going to happen. But he knows what to do in order to increase the chances that over the long run, he has bountiful crops as opposed to meager ones. And it's the same with our state of mind. When we do these practices and when we learn what the Buddha taught, we're actually learning what to do to improve the chances that over time, more of our mind moments, more moments in our lives will be wholesome and skillful, happy, peaceful, loving than not. So in that sense, of course, we can say we're trying to change our state of mind over the long run in a skillful way. So I wanted to jump now. Oh, maybe I should. So let me mention a couple of tips that he put in too. He often will say that every object that's noticed, whether it's a thought or a body sensation or an emotion or any physical object, a state of mind or anything that's noticed, we use that as an opportunity to practice awareness. That is, everything that arises in our experience can be taken as an opportunity to practice awareness, not to get caught up in the object itself, although certain thoughts and emotions, you know, really grab our attention and we really get tempted to, like, oh, get right in there and figure out that thought stream and change the thoughts and create a better model and these types of things. But the practice is to not get engaged with the thoughts, but rather to stay back, or the emotions, but to stay back and abide in awareness, and to keep the eye on the quality of the observing mind over and over, and to keep noticing, oh, is there desire arising? Is there aversion arising? And to keep noticing that, and then over time to notice whether we're having more or fewer moments with desire and aversion, or more moments of stability of mind and wisdom. And it doesn't take a lot of effort. See, this is the mind really picks a fight, doesn't it? With this idea of when Sayadaw says the goal is to be aware from the moment we wake up until the moment we fall asleep. Doesn't the mind pick a fight with that? Doesn't the mind say, "Oh, that's impossible"? Well, what is he talking about? That's and then it's funny. We kind of go towards like, well, it's hard enough for me to come to Common Ground and sit, you know, once a week or twice a week, or it's hard enough for me to do a daily sit, you know, in the morning or something like that. How am I supposed to do it from the morning we wake up to the morning we fall asleep? And in answer to that, Sayadaw says, well, wait a minute. If that's what you say, you got the wrong idea about effort. Because in any given moment, it doesn't really take, I mean, check in your own experience, but isn't it true that in any given moment, it doesn't really take a lot of effort to just shift from the object that's being known to what knows the object? Like right now, are you aware that you're seeing? If your eyes are open, are you aware that you're seeing? maybe 15 seconds ago, you weren't aware that you're seeing, but my saying that makes you aware that you're seeing. And that didn't take a lot of energy, did it? Or just to know that we're aware. Oh, yeah, there's seeing happening. I'm aware. Or there is awareness. It doesn't take a lot. But that's all it takes. So insofar as there is effort, it's the effort to just maintain it from moment to moment, as opposed to that individual moment of being aware. It's the continuity, it's maintaining continuity that can seem a little challenging. Now, how do we maintain continuity? Here's what he says, and I find it really rings true in my experience over these past years. You know, at first it really feels, it does feel kind of difficult. It does feel like a bit of a, like you're bringing a certain amount of, you know, even as I'm talking now, I'm kind of squaring my shoulders. I'm taking a deeper breath because I can remember the kind of, what's actually quite a wholesome intention to maintain awareness. And you say, okay, I'm determined to do this. And Saito is very clear that he's very much in favor of this kind of positive intention to stay aware. That's a desire that you actually really want to cultivate. That's a positive desire to be aware continuously. So get in touch with that and stay with that intention. That's one of his tips, especially early on. Just know that you really want to be awake for your life and to be maintain awareness as much as possible. So wholesome. Really straightens the spine, you know. And then just start doing it. And, you know, you can do so many things. I'm sure many of you have heard in other Dharma talks or Dharma books. You can put Post-its around the house. You can make different visual cues, a cue to be aware, like when you go through a door or any kind of frame, that'll be an awareness reminder. You can set things on your computers to send you notes. You can have a married couple, you can, or any couple, you can kind of encourage each other that way. There's so many different ways to encourage that. I mean, for me, I've actually found all those to be helpful. One thing that's been very, very helpful for me has been this thing about what happens in the very first moment of awareness in the morning and at the very last moment of awareness at night. I do this all the time. I do this every single day without fail for years. And now it's very natural for me. And I'll describe the practice in a second, but I mean, it really helps me in terms of the momentum of the day, of the number of times that the reminder for awareness comes up naturally, not on the computer or not through any of these cues, but just pops right up a lot, is simply for me to, you know, I literally, as I'm falling asleep, I'm just noticing my body, noticing my breath, noticing awareness moment to moment to moment until I fall asleep. And it usually takes me 15 or 20 minutes to fall asleep. That's the way my body's set. So I get about 15 or 20 minutes of continuous awareness there. Now, when I do that, I wake up with the same mind exactly. It's just like 8 hours later or 7.5 hours later, it just comes right back. It's like my mind and body didn't even know I was away for 7.5 hours or whatever. I just wake up and even with my eyes closed, I go, I'm aware. And my consciousness is shifting to awareness now and awakeness. And the next thing I'll do, and I'm doing this very consciously with awareness, the next thing I'm going to do is open my eyes. And then my eyes are open. Then I say, oh, seeing is happening. This is all what I do every day. Seeing is happening. Then I notice the intention to get out of bed and move into a sitting posture. Then I notice the intention to stand up. And I'm doing that all the way through the bathroom and you know, like with relatively good continuity of awareness. And it's just from that thing about last moment before you fall asleep and then first moment when you wake up. And it's just been, and I really find that when you have those, when the moments are like that in the first part of the day, it really sets it for the rest of the day. It's very powerful. So that's a little tip from my own practice, and I've heard other people talk about it. And there does come a time when you notice that while in the early days it seems so hard to continually remember there comes a time when you suddenly realize that's starting to happen on its own. It doesn't mean it's always going to happen on its own. In my experience, it can fall off. Like you can go through a long period of getting busy at work or some really, really strong attack of the eye or whatever, or a big emotional thing, and then you can lose the momentum. But there can be a point at which there's a lot of internal momentum. It's very nice. And I just wanted to finish, and then I'd love to have some discussion or if you have any questions. I wanted to finish on this point because it's what I'm talking about right now, that shift in momentum that's so important over the long run, especially when you see it happen. It really builds up confidence. It really builds up faith in the practice. And things naturally start to go better, as I'm sure most of you have discovered. When there's mindfulness, things tend to go better in life because you're not just doing things out of that reactivity that we're so accustomed to, but rather there's a pause and you can just notice what's happening and wait until a naturally wise response comes up or a thought of how to act comes up that comes out of wisdom. So there's so many positive benefits to just being aware. The point I really want to just end on is to say that when we get to that point, that the crucial thing that's happening is there's a very noticeable diminishing of the sense of I, of the sense of me. That what is happening at that moment as things shift into this kind of naturally self-regenerating awareness is that awareness is happening and good things are happening because of continuous awareness, not because of anything that an I is doing, but because another kind of natural process is kind of taking charge. And the knowing of it is there, but the knowing of it is not you either. The knowing of it is just the knowing of it. And it's a very peaceful and grounded. It's got qualities of sky and ground in it at the same time, because it's both very light and very free, but at the same time very grounded, because awareness notices what's going on at all levels. And confident decisions can be made, and confidence in one's self, not as an ego, but as a being, is more and more present. And this is the point of the practice, the ultimate point of the practice, that we intuitively know that we improve to the degree that we can let go of some idea about an I that's in charge. When people ask the Buddha to please summarize in one line, one sentence, what his entire teaching was, he would say, nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine. That's my teaching, he would say. That goes to the question of why. Why we want 24/7 awareness. So we covered some hows, and then we just hit the why. How is this landing with you? And do you have any reflections to share or questions or comments on the teaching or any challenges that you've had in the practice? Yeah.
I'm always a little befuddled by the idea of continual awareness. For me, the word mind, you know, they say the mind and the heart are the same, but nobody uses the heart. A lot of people don't. And if I'm tracking my heart, it doesn't change so quickly, or it feels like I can be aware of sort of a feeling tone that's it's one thing for a while. It can morph into another, but it's not like my mind would eat every moment. It just seems endless. So that's one thing. you know, the idea of forgiveness and the idea of compassion and all the Brahma Viharas seem to be a sort of a different art in a way than the art of being continually aware. And if it's nirvana to live in the Brahma Viharas, I'm inclined to go that way. So I'm inclined to really say, boy, I forgive you, Anne, for not being continually aware. Oh, how hard it is to have a 15-year-old who talks to you like that. And one other thing about mindful, continual, and all the time. My mind works in the way the art happens or insight in certain ways. It does come out of a certain kind of darkness where you don't really know exactly what you're working on, and then you figure it out. I can't imagine having discoveries like that from being cursing out each moment with awareness.
You can't. You can't, yeah. Yeah. Well, okay, a couple of things there. So I've been there. I've been absolutely where you are with that confusion. And for me, what's helped is to recognize that there is a semantic, in my opinion, there's a semantic problem here. Because the word mind is used a lot. And it's used in there's actually two different ways that it's used. But it's not always specified which way it's being used. Now, there's the mind that produces thoughts. And so we talk about the monkey mind, the thinking mind, the one that's just firing judgments and analyses and parsing, like you said, and all that. And the hell with it. You know, I mean, that's like, ooh, we all know how that goes. That's a difficult thing. Again, that's what the mind does. We don't want to pick a fight with that mind. We want to know it, like I said, just like it's happening with nature. But we want to be very careful about not jumping in and getting caught in it, because then we become it and we get all tight in the way that you were referring to in your comments. Now, there's another way that the word mind is used, where mind means awareness, which is an entirely different thing. Awareness is the aware mind is the noticing of that other mind. So when mind is used that way, we're talking about just the knowing, the constant, continual knowing. And as long as we can, for me, as long as I'm able to recognize those two different functions and sort of not get too hung up about, oh, wait, the mind, what definition is? I just go to the knowing and feeling of the knowing on one side and then the production of thoughts on the other, that frees me up and I can just stay in mind as awareness, if you will. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because it's also not often talked about, or it can be challenging in the practice to understand what is the connection between continuous awareness, such as is being taught here, and loving kindness, patience, honesty, generosity, and the Brahma Viharas. What's the connection? Well, that gives me a chance to show you this. Because, you know, the thing is to notice, like really in our own experience, what happens when we're continuously aware in this way. What starts to happen with the heart? Really, I mean, just of all the things we're noticing, breath, body, thoughts, emotions, and all the rest of it, let's be aware what's happening with the heart. How's the heart operating? When we do continuous awareness for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 30 minutes like we do here, how is the heart different when we leave here than it was when we came in, for example? We can explore with that. And isn't it true that even after 5 minutes of sitting in here, the heart starts to be grateful for the quiet? It starts to be open to all the beings in this room. There starts to be compassion for this suffering being, you know, or whatever it is, whatever the suffering is. There starts to be compassion for it, and all the little knots of the day start to dissolve a bit. In other words, this practice of continuous awareness activates and triggers the Brahma-viharas. It does. And what I find so wonderful about Sayadaw's teachings, in a way, is, you know, it really, it invites us to do this practice and then to just notice the impact on the heart as a many other things that can be noticed. Now, I pick this up because, you know, I talked about anatta, non-self, just now, right view, things that are happening in nature. If we can notice that things are just happening in nature, we don't think that everything is happening as a result of what we're doing or not doing. And that gives us some freedom. Another way to understand anatta, which sometimes can sound quite esoteric and like, what does that mean anyway? This is a poster. And by the way, I put a pile of these posters out in the lobby. And I, because our meditation center prints these up and we give them out to people for free. And I'm offering this to anyone who wants on your way out, pick it up. It's called the Letting Go poster. And it's a list of the 10 paramis or perfections of character in the Buddhist teachings. Of the Brahma Viharas that are kind of expanded into 10 from 4 right here. So the 10 so-called perfections of character, generosity, integrity, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolve, loving kindness, and equanimity. Now, if you think about it, it's like, what are we doing when we meditate? If we let go of a thought that's bothering us to go back to the breath, aren't we exercising patience? Aren't we giving patience a little muscle curl right there? A little rep of patience every time we go back to the breath? And aren't we doing a rep of generosity with ourselves when we do that? And aren't we doing a rep of loving kindness, you know? And so this is actually what we are doing when we come back to awareness. We're actually practicing every one of the Brahma Viharas. We're doing reps. We're doing Brahma Vihara reps with every time we come back to the breath. And what's really interesting is that if you look at each one of these qualities, they are pure and wholesome qualities because there is no I in there. What is generosity? Generosity is like acting, so overriding the sense of I need and letting it go, to be out there, you know. Generosity is a virtue to the degree that there is not a grasping self, right? And it's the true with all four Brahma Viharas and all 10 of the paramis. This is a chart of no self right here. It's in that when we meditate and we do these reps, we're actually repping or repeating or giving the momentum to living not as that contracted egoic self, but literally replacing that identity with a manifestation of these qualities. That's who we become. We loosen up both egoically and physically, and we become more these. We are operating as these, you know. So those were remarks that were meant to kind of bridge, hopefully, you know, what this practice is about in relationship to the Brahma Viharas. I'm really glad you asked that question. And feel free to pick up the poster on the way out. It's a present from the Rochester Meditation Center to you. So we have time for maybe one more question, one or two more, or comment or anything. Yeah. Here, can you do this?
Yes, absolutely. An image that helps me is from the book Unexpected Freedom, actually, from a suggestion from Mark, that there's the waves of the ocean and then the ocean itself. So the way he explains that is the waves of the ocean are like the thoughts of the mind or heart, however you want to fill that in, and that the ocean itself is the heart itself or the mind itself. And so you kind of, you know, you see both, right? There's the waves, which could be dangerous at times. They could cause horrible, horrible tragedies, or they could be kind, almost absent, and it looks like a very beautiful sight. But it's still, they're both part of the ocean. They're both part of the mind and heart. So taking your suffering with your joys, and that's the whole of you.
Nice. Yeah, thank you for that. Yes, the knowing, or the awareness, yeah, yeah. Perfect. Oh, yes, yes. That's something that the mind makes up. The mind says you can't do both. That's a very interesting point. And this is a actual little hurdle in practice. I know, you know, because the mind, by the way, this whole practice that I'm describing, the conventional mind is not happy about this at all. At all. Because it's like this little child that's saying, we're not going to be paying so much attention to you anymore. And the mind just throws a ton of tantrums. And it's a very smart mind. And one of the things it says is, you can't have global awareness. It's impossible. You can't know that you're doing something and do it at the same time. Can't walk and chew gum at the same time, the mind is saying. And you have to know that as a thought. You have to know that that's a thought. Then you have to say, is that true? Well, in my experience, but check it out for yourself, I can know that I'm touching a doorknob and twisting it and opening it while I'm doing it. I've discovered that I can do that. You know? And I can actually say words and be aware that I'm saying words at the same time. The first time that I recognized this was like a thunderclap. Was like years ago, I listened to one of Mark's talks on this. I was driving up from Rochester to Minneapolis to listen to a talk, and I thought I would test it out. I maintained unbroken awareness to my breath from Rochester to Minneapolis, 90 minutes. And my wife was right there, and I was even having conversations with her. I didn't miss a single breath until I got into the city and I was doing city driving. Then I did. I did. Then I was like, I got to Common Ground. I go, oh, darn it. I missed, you know, Hiawatha Avenue. I was out of it, you know. But it was like 90 minutes of driving safely, more safely than usual, actually. So just be careful, because the mind will pick a fight with all of this. It's not happy, because the mind, in the sense of the, you know, the thinking, grasping, thought-producing, judging, analyzing mind, not the aware mind, but that mind, we're putting it in second place now. And we're allowing it to be a servant instead of the master. There's a switch happening. And we're testing out what's it like for awareness to be in charge. Awareness that carries with it wisdom, patience, loving kindness, equanimity, and all the other things we wish for ourselves. Well, that we wish ourselves to be. We wish to be. Not to have, but to be. Well, it's 9:00. Stay aware. Thanks for having me. Thanks for listening. See you soon.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.